The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Krotowski, and this week we're looking at the modern coders and the ways that they are being dragged from the bedroom into the cold light of day. This week sees the UK's largest codathon, Young Rewired State. We speak with participants, founders and judges, the multi-talented Lily Cole and number 10 Downing Street's Jonathan Luff. We also find out from one of gaming's greatest, David Braben, what he would do with the Raspberry Pi. So keep listening to the next 30 minutes to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Over the next week, over 400 kids between the ages of 13 and 18 are spending their holidays coding. It's Young Rewired State, the UK's national festival of hacking. It brings kids together from all over the country to create something digital, something wonderful, something open, and something totally new. It's a competition, of course, culminating in a giant festival of code this weekend, Saturday the 11th of August, where special guest star judges including Lily Cole and Conrad Wolfram will be putting these incredibly talented kids and their technologies through their paces. We spoke with founder Emma Mulqueenie on the phone and managed to drag ourselves out of bed very early on a Tuesday morning to see what was happening already at one of the coding centres. Emma, thank you very much for joining us.
That's a pleasure.
Emma, you're in between various venues today because Young Rewired State is an event that's happening across the UK. Tell me a little bit about it, about the whole concept.
Well, it started in 2009 when I ran an event called National Hack the Government Day at the beginning of the year, which was all about getting developers to engage with open government data and to encourage government to release its data so that wonderful things could happen. I noticed that our event was full of people who were probably 30 plus and no one there really under the age of 25. And I thought that that was probably a bit of a shame and more than likely something I'd done to make the event seem dull to younger people. So I ran a Young Rewired State at the end of 2009, which was specifically about kids aged 18 and under, getting them to engage with open government data.
How did you make it more attractive? What's the key instigators, would you say?
Well, I managed to persuade Google to let us use their complex for the weekend, and I thought first of all venue, and secondly we went out to a lot of the gaming forums rather than some of the kind of more developer focused events that I'd kind of promoted it before. But it was very difficult, and we couldn't. It took us 3 months to find 50 kids that could program, which kind of highlighted to me a problem in this country sort of greater than the fact that people weren't engaging with open government data.
Well, fast forward to now and it's pretty impressive. You went from hacking together 50 kids in 2009 to now where you've got, between 400 and 500 kids under the age of 18 across venues across the UK.
Yes, exactly. So we do. We have about 425 kids working in various centres across the UK, and it's hugely exciting. It's grown so much this year, but I think what's very interesting and the thing that is exciting me about this is that as this scales, it's not just about scaling a number. It's about the fact that we've got more hyperlocal groups of kids who are engaging with each other, but being mentored and taught by a worldwide network of people who are experts in their field. And that, to me, I think is really exciting. So that's kind of one point of scale. And then the other thing is that at the end of the event in the past, we've only ever done a quick show and tell day, but this time we're having a big, what we're calling the Festival of Code in Birmingham, where the kids actually get to spend a couple of days together really properly networking. Once we get all of these hundreds of kids out of their hyperlocal centres and all together so that they can suddenly see what a huge community they're a part of. And that's where everything really starts to get exciting for us in the UK, I think, because this is the beginning of a network that is really personal to each child, but also has the interest and the care of expert people from all around the world, the ones that are mentoring remotely as well as the ones that are mentoring in centres.
And tell me a little bit about the makeup of these kids. Everybody's under the age of 18, and I know that you've tried to make a big push, whereas, you know, in 2009 the difficulty was getting 50 kids. Now the difficulty, I imagine, is getting a varied bunch of kids.
Yes, yes. So I made a bit of a mistake by trying to make the focus this year on upping our percentage of girls that attended, because previously we've only had around 5% of girls turn up. I say I made a mistake because actually by drawing a big red ring around this problem and by highlighting the fact that no girls wanted to cave, I made the whole situation far worse for the girls that had actually signed up and the ones that might have been thinking about signing up going, oh my God, I'm not going anywhere near this because no one else wants to either. So I decided then to address it by not focusing on that problem, but actually trying to move this away from the domain of the true geek, I suppose, the teenager who is the one who's kind of sitting in his bedroom teaching himself how to code, and move it kind of more mainstream and something that would be attractive to everybody so that people know that it's not that difficult to learn how to code, to try and remove some of the fear of the knowledge that you need to have in order to come in the first place.
This fits rather nicely actually with number 10's agenda at the moment, trying to get more coding in schools, does it not?
Yes, it does. It definitely does. And I think that the agenda in number 10 and in DfE and indeed sort of everywhere in industry to get more kids coding is something that is very important. And there's lots of sort of misrepresentation, I suppose, of the kind of person that you need to be in order to become a programmer. You don't need to be a nerdy male. You know, anybody can do it. It is not difficult to learn how to code. You can learn in a year. And so it does fit very nicely. And I think that peer-to-peer learning, specifically with regards to programming, which is a subject that just changes daily, the skills that you can pick up, the things that you can learn. There are new programming languages being written. There are new environments in which people can play. There's so many more tools being produced for kids that actually it's very difficult to keep up unless you are doing peer-to-peer learning, which is exactly what we do in YRS. We set up that the ability for kids to learn from each other as well as mentors.
So tell me how the week is going to play. It's today is Tuesday, and it lasts until when? Tell me how it will roll out.
I should talk you through it.
Thank you.
So we've already had terrible Monday. Monday is always very difficult because the kids turn up, they're not really sure whether their skills are good enough and they're not really sure what's going on, and it's all about ideation on Monday. It's very hard work for everybody and everybody's usually exhausted, kids as well, Monday night. But the excitement has already started because people know what they're going to build. So from Monday through Thursday, the kids go into their local centres and the ones that are being mentored remotely stay at home and sort of are mentored remotely. And they build a digital tool. Now, whether that be a website or whether that be an app or a game or, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. But they build something, they program something. We ask that they use at least one piece of open data. This is just because we want them to engage with us and for them to know what the potential is for all of the open data that's being released at the moment by everybody. And on the Friday, all of the kids get together in their centres and then come together to Birmingham. And everybody gets to Birmingham to the Custard Factory by 5:30, where we have pizza for 500 people and a series of talks, very informal kind of fireside chat type talks. And we've got Alistair coming from London Zoo, bringing the drones that they use to photograph Africa. We've got Eben coming from Raspberry Pi. We've got all sorts of wonderful people coming to talk to them. But they will also carry on coding as well and preparing for Saturday, which is big show and tell time. So every single child that's taken part gets to showcase in the morning what they've been building. And then winners are selected in four different categories. So we've got Best in Show, Best Example of Coding, Code a Better Country, and Wish I'd Thought of That. Those are the four prize categories.
And the judges that you have this year, they're quite a good bunch of judges, aren't they?
They are, yes. We have 20 judges in the morning, and then in the afternoon we have 5 judges. So we've got Jonathan Luff from Number 10, who judged last year and loved it. We've got Lily Cole, who has set up Impossible.com and knows an awful lot about social enterprise. We have got Thomas Grassell from our sponsors, SAP. We have got Aral Balkan, who is a designer and is amazing. And then we've got Conrad Wolfram, who everybody is extremely excited about, not only because of Wolfram Alpha, but also because of Mathematica.
So, Emma, we went to the Mars Space in central London to meet a couple of your judges, Lily Cole and Jonathan Luff. Let's hear what they have to say. Well, here we are at Young Rewired State at the Moz Space in central London. And I'm joined by two of the judges for this week's event, Jonathan Luff from Number 10 and Lily Cole from Impossible.com. Now, Jonathan, tell me, why is it that you're interested in being involved with this event?
Well, my involvement dates back more than a year. I met the force of nature that is Emma Mulqueeney just under 2 years ago. We were talking about open data, we were talking about the use of data in government, and we got to talking about her Young Rewired State project and how important we both felt it was to encourage the development of coding skills, how vital that is for all of our futures, and she talked me through the Young Rewired State project back then, and I said if there's ever anything I could do to get involved, then she only needed to let me know. And she said, well, as it happens, would you be interested in judging? And I said, yeah, where do I sign up? So that was how I got involved. I was a judge in August 2011, and frankly it was one of the best things I've ever been involved in. The kids were fabulous. The products were inspiring. Some of the things that they had done in a week were as good as anything that you would see developed by professionals, usually at great cost, I might add, were inspirational. And they were using data from government, they were using data from other open sources, they were challenging assumptions, they were doing some really fantastic things. And so I've been a very, very willing volunteer and participant ever since. So delighted to be a judge again.
Well, you can see by your face, actually, your eyes just totally lit up. They just sort of flared when you started talking about the things that you saw last year. Now, Lily, this is your first time judging Young Rewired State. What is it that you're going to be looking for?
I don't know, actually, in all honesty. I think that even if I knew I'd be lying, and that would like make it less exciting. I'm looking forward to being surprised. I'm looking forward to hopefully having the similar reactions that Jonathan just showed of eyes lighting up, because I've been working on a project in the internet space for a year, and I know how difficult it is to find coders, and there's much more, it's like oil. there's a limited supply and a lot of demand. And it's a space that really, you know, needs development and attention, especially from younger generations. And I've seen that what can be made and built in a very short space of time, and as Jonathan said, by contrast, you know, what a lot of money and time can also go into not building. And so I'm really excited to see hopefully the kind of former end of that spectrum and be super humbled and impressed by these genius little coder kids.
Well, Lily, I'm really curious about sort of where you're coming from with this. What's inspired you in the tech space that you are kind of using almost as a benchmark, or at least a platform, a scaffolding that you're going to be looking at the stuff that these kids are building?
I've accidentally kind of found myself in the tech space for the last year based on an idea I had a year and a half ago that came from a more social political perspective. And through that journey, I think I've increasingly, quite dramatically realized how powerful technology and the internet is. I mean, it seems a given, but in changing kind of human behavior and human possibilities, potentially sometimes for the worse, but really potentially sometimes for the better. I mean, you look at like social media, for example, as a terrain, and there's never been anything in thousands of years that's changed kind of that many people's behavior so significantly in such a short space of time. And I think that we don't even know kind of what the possibilities are yet and how technology can help kind of remap our future. And as to your last question before, again, the next generation is a generation that will create that future, and then the next and the next and the next. And so the kind of, there's a kind of very potent mix of looking at the next generation and looking at technology and looking at the possibilities that that can kind of provoke and inspire, and hopefully a lot of very innovative thinking that will make more eyes pop like Jonathan's did.
There's going to be a lot that you guys are going to be looking at over the next week or so. I don't know how many kids are going to be taking part in this, but as you said, Jonathan,
it's fantastic. I think Emma has done an extraordinary job here. I think as you might know, this is very much it's crowdfunded part of this effort. She raised a lot of the money to put on this year's event through contributions from the community. She had some great support from Mozilla and from SAP and from some other commercial partners. But this is really a community organization. There are, I think, 400 or 500 kids taking part this year. It's such a, you know, there's real text-based growth here. I mean, this is a hockey stick, and the centres, as I said, there's 40 of them all around the country. There's so many that they'll be that they're going to be. It's a bit like the Olympics. There are going to be heats then finals before Lily and I get a chance to really get our hands on some of the products and applications that are being developed. So it's really exciting, and you know, as you'll know from speaking to Emma yourself, you know, she's also very passionate about encouraging more girls and young women to get involved in this. And I think, you know, that's been it's been quite a challenge, but there's real progress there. There are many more young women and girls involved this year. Of the total number of 500, there's a really strong contingent, and it's really growing. I'm very excited about that.
Lily, I imagine that you're a bit relieved that you don't have to go through the 400 to 500 entries that are going to be there. Obviously, it would be hugely inspiring, but it would be, you know, a heck of a lot of time. What do you expect to be inspired by?
I love it when people are like better and smarter than me. It's like, it's just such a good feeling, and to feel really humbled, especially when they're younger than you. So, I think. I mean, I can't code. I actually went on Code Academy a few months ago, and I was really desperate in my search for coders. And, and it's a language I just don't speak. And so I'm just excited, to kind of be impressed and humbled. And also just to see what ideas people have had. I think, you know, I'm really, I guess there's two sides to that coin. There's the skill of it, and then there's also the ambition. And I love big thinkers, and I love out-of-the-box thinking, and I'm kind of excited to see what they've come up with.
Huge thanks to Jonathan and Lily, both incredibly multi-talented. They have their jobs cut out for them. Tell me a little bit about what you hope the judges will be inspired by this year.
I think what's most inspiring for the judges to see is that what the kids have built in a week is usually something that they will have thought of or will have tried to get built themselves, or a problem that they're always trying to solve. You know, it's just something that will resonate with them. And then this child or this group of children will have stumbled across that problem, built a solution to it, and then presented it in such a fashion that they're just so confident in their skills, and they're very good at, once they've actually built something, they're very good at showcasing what they've done. And I think it's that confidence plus the level of skill that these kids actually have, plus the amazing sense of community that you can just feel in the room when they present what they've done during the week. That's what blows people away.
They certainly have confidence. We spoke with a couple of the contenders at this morning's Young Rewired State. They managed to pull themselves out of their beds for the crack of dawn. Well, let's hear from some of those young coders.
I'm Gideon Brett.
Nice to meet you, Gideon. How old are you?
16.
You're 16. So tell me, how did you get involved with Young Rewired State?
I found it on Twitter last year and then decided to join up.
This is your second time around?
Yeah.
What was it like the first time?
I was really unprepared and my laptop kept breaking down, so I spent 3 or 4 days trying to get it fixed. But I did manage to help make something, and then we didn't win anything, but it was still fun.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that's why you're back. You came back kind of to reclaim, you know, to say, no, look, this is actually what I can do. What are you doing this time?
We're making this app where you input a bunch of data, and then it comes out saying how much tax you'd pay, and if the tax budget's been released for next year, say how much a difference there'll be as well.
So is this going for the number 10 vote?
I have no clue. Thought it was a good idea.
How did you come up with this idea? This is quite a...
I didn't come up with it. It was someone else on my team came up with it, and I thought it was a good idea, so we all decided that we'd do it.
How many people on your team? Tell me a little bit about how Young Rewired State works.
What they do is we get given a bunch of data from the government, and we go sit in, sit in a room with people, and we think of an idea, and if we think it's good, we go with it. But the idea can change over the week, so...
And you've got a whole week basically to develop this. Tell me a little bit about that process. Is everybody here constantly? Like, is there a lot of pizza? Talk to me about that.
There's a snack bar here with lots of free food, so that's all right. And we're right next to Chinatown, so it's Chinese. That's also good. But generally, it's more we try and work on, try and code, get all the data, try and make it workable from front end and back end, but. Usually, by the end of the week, we have something that can be used, but it needs to be refined and stuff if we want to continue it on.
Why do you choose to do Young Rewired State instead of doing something on your own or with, you know, a group of people at home?
I can meet more people here. I can put it on, like, personal statement for when I want to apply to uni in September. And it's quite fun. I like this sort of thing.
So I'm joined by Alex. Alex, how old are you?
I'm 13.
You're 13, and how did you get involved in Young Rewired State?
Well, my mother's friend wanted to send her child, but he couldn't come, so she recommended that I went.
And are you a coder? Are you a geek?
I like to say I'm a geek. I would like to say that I like coding a lot. I find it very addictive, and I have to force myself sometimes to take a break.
How did you start coding? Where did that come from?
I don't know really. I just started a few years ago with a program called Scratch, and then it just continued. Now I know Visual Basic, HTML, CSS, Scratch, and it's really fun to program.
How did you learn all of these languages? This is an amazing array, this amazing library of things that you've got in your brain.
Visual Basic is I don't know that much of it. It's just something we've done at school. Scratch became a little obsession for about 6 months.
Now, Scratch is the one that allows you sort of to pull modules in, isn't it? It's quite a user-friendly programming language, isn't it?
Very user-friendly. It's very interesting to... You got so many options with Scratch, even though you can't, like, type it all up.
And tell me about your idea. I hear it's pretty spectacular.
We are doing something called Animal Olympics, where we're taking some BBC athlete data from the BBC website and for Team GB, all 550 athletes. And we're also taking some data about animals from London Zoo, which we will use to... which we will, like, make a little comparison, which animal is closest to which... athlete, or which athlete is closest to which animal, and also individual data about athletes, like shortest athlete, tallest athlete, and stuff like that.
Wow! And will I be able to see this? Will I be able to compare?
Yeah, we will, once we finish, hopefully we'll finish in a week's time, and animalolympics.org. We've already got our own domain name.
That's amazing. Well, good luck, Alex. I hope you have a great time this week. What do you hope to get out of this week?
Learning a few more languages, integrating them with each other, having fun.
Thanks to Alex. And that project is bound to win a few fans. It lives at animalolympics.org. So coming back to you, Emma. There's an interesting thing here. You mentioned that you had the folks behind Raspberry Pi, and later on in the podcast, we're going to be speaking with David Braben, the games developer, about Raspberry Pi and his interest in it. There is a difference here, though, between hardware that's being developed and software that's being developed. Young Rewired State is very much focused on the software, but do you hope that some of these kids will move into the future of hardware development?
I think they probably will naturally, because I think that they are so inspired to solve the things that frustrate them, that once they've got those skills, they will find easier ways for people to engage with technology. And I think that, you know, there is absolutely no doubt that that will include hardware. And most of them are going to be programming or are going to be using their Raspberry Pis and Arduino this year. I know it's featuring highly on on the list of kits that kids are bringing. So yes, I do think it would be interesting for them to move into hardware, and I'd love to see what they create.
Is there anything that you can see already, just from what you've been watching since 2009, new directions that these kids are thinking that us, you know, crusty old grown-ups who've got years of experience behind us, but may actually be entrenched in our technological experiences? Anything that these kids are bringing to the table that is utterly surprising?
I think what's utterly surprising is the simplicity, and it's something that as they grow a little bit older and in the alumni, the things that I'm seeing is kind of being carried through into their work, whether that's their own businesses or working with other people. They find the simplest solution to a problem. They don't try to complicate things. So there can be obviously a kind of, you know, it's tempting to find a kind of a deeply complicated and a solution to something where it's just kind of, you know, if we solve this way, then we can also solve this other problem, and we can also solve this other problem. They don't. What they seem to do, what the kids seem to be doing, is taking a problem, solving it, moving on to the next one, solving it, moving on to the next one, and creating a product to solve each one of those things quickly and effectively. And I think that's a real kind of lesson for me, and it's something that I think it would be worth keeping an eye on, certainly as the kind of digital renaissance moves forward and all sorts of people are kind of trying to come up with all sorts of, you know, new big ideas. I think the things that we need are simplicity, and that's definitely the way that every single child that comes to Young Rewired State does that. They just find the simplest solution, they build it, and then move on to something else.
Emma Mulqueeney from Young Rewired State, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
The reason behind the explosion of coding talent that came out of the 1980s in the UK has frequently been put down to the hardware that was available to budding bedroom geeks. The BBC Micro and the ZX Spectrum are two that I frequently hear about. So they put the power of the new digital world into the hands of the people. Fast forward 3 decades, and new open hardware is inspiring a new generation like the kids at Young Rewired State. One of the most exciting and recent developments has been the Raspberry Pi. Here's gaming legend David Braben speaking with The Guardian's Keith Stewart about his role in this new revolutionary technology.
My name is David Braben. I'm one of the founding trustees of Raspberry Pi Foundation. I'm also CEO of Frontier.
David, you did a talk this morning on Raspberry Pi, which is, of course, your low-cost, simple, but high-spec PC, which is almost the size of a credit card, slightly larger. We talked to you about it last year, but it'd be good to sort of catch up with you. It launched in February, I think.
That's right.
How was the lead-up to the launch, and how have things been since?
It was very exciting and also quite worrying, because in 2011, we, the founders of the charity, had pre-purchased 10,000 components for building Raspberry Pis, but the demand looked like it was vastly higher than that. So we did deals with Premier Farnell and with RS Electronics to do distribution and also to do manufacturing to get the numbers up, because we couldn't afford to go much higher in numbers. And so there was a big change of plan. But having said that, I think even with hindsight, it was absolutely the right thing to do. And very, very pleased with what we did. And we did then a coordinated launch on the 29th of February this year. And we haven't really looked back.
Can you tell us about the specs of the machine as it stands now? You've released it as a developer unit at the moment, haven't you? How does it sort of compare, I guess, to a desktop PC that I might have at home?
Well, it's a desktop PC from probably a few years ago, or more importantly, it's a mobile phone you might have now in terms of performance. And so, to be honest, for education, it's actually a brutally powerful beast, because the sorts of machines we were looking at with Raspberry Pi, the sorts of things, sort of experiences we wanted to recreate, or opportunities for children, it's vastly more powerful. You know, so for learning, you can actually do phenomenal things with Raspberry Pi that we couldn't do in the days back on things like the Commodore PET and the BBC Micro and the Acorn Atom.
Okay. And the whole idea with it, obviously, is to bring back that era of these programmable computers in schools. The whole idea with Raspberry Pi, isn't it, is to enable these computers to be distributed to schools so that kids can learn programming again. Because for many years, all they were learning in school was ICT. They're learning how to use Word and Excel and crap like that. And the whole idea is, let's get them back learning proper programming languages. So have you had much input from schools so far? I mean, obviously it's very, very early, but I'm just wondering, has it got into schools and what are you finding as a result?
Well, it has. It's mostly gone into things like after-school clubs. So some of the things I showed in the talk there's a robot that people are making, in fact, a scout group in that case, which was, hats off to them, fantastic group called Boroughton Scouts in the south of England. Other schools are using it for teaching. There was a piece that the BBC kindly let me use, which was showing teaching programming to 7 to 9-year-olds, which is amazing. I mean, I didn't even know that was coming. I think it's fantastic. You know, and it's things like that. So it's not officially gone blanket into the curriculum or anything like that. But a lot of schools are using it as a nice way of teaching things and engaging the kids. Because I think you say to a kid, when you want to write a program or learn programming, they don't really engage with that. Say, want to make an app, and they get all excited. You know, it's just the modern talk. So we're not trying to, this isn't supposed to be a nostalgic thing. This is supposed to be creating an opportunity that we had. And we're doing it in a way that's appropriate to today. You know, so a lot of the things are timeless, you know, how you program, how you learn. But it's really what we're trying to do is create the lower rungs on the ladder, which leads to what is today actually quite a complex process. And some of the learning tools that you see in universities, and excellent tools like Microsoft XNA and things like that, it's very, very hard to come to grips with if you haven't got either a very well-meaning friend or parent, and a lot of knowledge, and potentially money to buy kit, which is the other thing. One of the things that I am forever indebted to is the Acorn Atom and the BBC Micro, which is very similar, which came with everything you needed to learn. You know, you don't have to, you know, it's an expensive enough thing to persuade parents to buy or to buy from your own money. Having to buy compilers, I mean, you know, a typical compiler is hundreds of pounds these days. And to even know that you need one of those, you ask a lot of teachers these days, they don't necessarily appreciate the amount of kit you need. So I think what it really tries to do is to engage children as creators, not just as consumers of software. And I think it's going to be ever more important as we go forward. We've got a gap of 10 or 12 years already where we haven't been educating children in programming. We used to have computer science at both GCSE and A-level prior to the introduction of ICT. And the sad thing is, that was killed off by ICT. Because of the problems of space on the national curriculum, it wasn't practical to teach computer science alongside ICT. There just wasn't room. And so computer science died, which in turn killed off computer science at A-level. And really problematically, and this is sort of where I came in, it killed off university applications. The start of the story, from my perspective, was noticing the number of graduates applying to Frontier decrease quite markedly. And we thought, oh, we've done something wrong, you know. But actually, it was across the board, and it was an earlier problem in universities. After 2001, they saw a dramatic drop-off in applicants in a rising market. And that is a tragedy. You know, other STEM subjects have suffered as well, but the computer science suffered really badly. And it was looking into the cause of that problem that certainly led me to ICT and led me to meet some of the other people who are now part of Raspberry Pi, who came at it from the educational point of view. And how to solve the problem.
So what comes on? So now it's been released. If I bought a Raspberry Pi, I hooked it into my monitor, switched it on, I guess it's a Linux OS, a Linux-based OS, but what else is on there that's going to help me learn to program?
Well, everything there is free. You can download different distributions. There's nothing to stop other people out there creating new things. I believe someone out there has done RISC OS. You know, that we've suggested Linux as a starting point because that's what we got off the ground with. With the educational release, we're looking at building layers of software on top of it where we can do things, something like BBC Basic, to help for self-learning, so it's really simple. And I think Linux is a bit daunting.
Yeah.
You know, particularly setting up an SD card to boot and downloading everything. And at the moment, I think, to be fair, probably needs a computer just to set up the SD card. So it's sort of not there yet, but in some ways it is, because we've engaged so many kids.
Yeah, yeah. So I presume, are you hoping that they learn how to program C and use a compiler themselves? Or I think you mentioned in your talk that you're implementing Scratch, which is MIT's drag and drop programming tool.
Yeah. Scratch is on there now, and was one of the first things we showed when we first showed it to the BBC. But in terms of I'm not after any particular objective like people learning C. What I want to see is people being more creative, more engaged. I'd love to see more girls being engaged with programming, because I think there are challenges there, particularly about the way it's taught and the way people are encouraged to play with computers. It's seen as a very boyish thing. It's a bit like cars. I know relatively few girls who are interested in cars per se. Obviously, they want a car because they want to be able to go from A to B, but it's a means to an end. So I'd like to see a lot more teaching of computing as a means to an end, not necessarily an end in itself. So I think there are lots of objectives going forward. It's not really just that people learn programming. They learn to be creative and create things of their own. It might be 3D art. It might be music. You know, it's to try and give tools so that people can look at the problem in a different way and have something that's theirs. You know, we in the South, the rich sort of Southeast, assume everyone has a computer at home. But actually, that's not quite the case. And what's worse is those who do, the parents really don't like the kid messing the computer up. Because I'm afraid of messing up my own computer, because I know what a pain in the neck it is to put it right. We all do. And it's not, even when we know more or less what we have to do, if it's anything non-trivial, you probably have to reinstall the operating system, and that's hateful. You know, so I wouldn't mess around with my own computer at the sort of low level unless I really knew what I was doing. So I think that's also partly it. If it's the kids, and it doesn't really matter if they destroy it, that's a very, very positive thing.
Because it's cheap in itself, but it's also a stateless computer, isn't it? So that which means that if anything goes wrong, you can instantly reboot the OS. Is that right? So you don't have to worry.
That's right. You can't, as they say in the parlance, brick it. You know, which you can do with phones and things like that. All Raspberry Pis, apart from the MAC address, which is the address it's used to identify to go onto the internet, every Raspberry Pi is the same when you reboot it. So the data is stored on the SD card. It is possible to damage that. We're looking at ways where we could change it just for the educational release to make it safer. So it's not that you're stopping hacking. We're just stopping people doing things accidentally they really didn't mean to do. And I think that will make it a bit more robust. But essentially, as you say, if you do something very wrong, you can just take the SD card out, put it back in, and it's fine. So I think it encourages people to experiment. We've also exposed a lot of, you know, there are data ports and things like that. We've even got breakout boards to allow people to solder lights, motors, things to that. I think what I had hoped for, in fact, possibly even when we last spoke, you said, what would you like to see with Raspberry Pi? I said, I'd like to see a robot with a big bit of blue tack with a Raspberry Pi on it and things sticking out of it driving around. I've seen things like that. It's amazing. It's really good. You know, we've seen, so the Raspberry Pi is the brain. We've got things coming that we want to make available to people, like cameras that work, that are very, very cheap, so around $1, really cheap. So you can use those to process images or just look at colors, so you can do color following on the floor. I mentioned in the talk, Logo. Now, a lot of people at the time criticized it because it was a very simple language. But people forget that actually it still engages people to see something physical on a computer, not just on a screen. You know, like something moving around, spotting that there's a table, backing off, turning, and all that sort of thing. And it's their software that's doing it. You think, oh, it's got to that. You know, if obstruction, turn right, you know, and they think, oh, maybe I should make it look to see which way is clearer. Because you might see it turns 270 degrees or something. You know, a bit like when you're watching an iRobot Roomba, which are another great piece of tech.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people lose sight of that. I mean, everyone from my generation knows the whole joke about, oh, I know programming, it's 10, print, Keith is great, 20, go to 10.
Yes.
But even that, just the first time you put that into a computer and see it reacting to what you've done, it doesn't have to be. And during your speech, you showed a little video from the BBC of those 7 to 9-year-olds coding, and there were little vox pops with those children. And one of them said, oh, it's great, I put in this line of code, and the light went on my computer. Yeah. And then I switched it off, and then the light went off, and they were so excited by that, fundamentally. So they, we're completely misjudging what children need. It's just that basic feedback.
I couldn't agree more. And I think the problem with the PC, there are so many layers of things between you and anything that is tangible that you can understand in the world, that it's both frightening, but also you don't engage with it. So when you're writing something in Word, you're typing on a machine, you're really doing what it says. You're filling in the gaps, like filling out a table. You're not controlling what's on the table in quite the same way. And so I think if PCs had user ports, that would be a big step along the direction that we wanted to go in. But this was the other thing that was sort of pushing us towards wanting to do a hardware platform. Partly because in our midst we have the knowledge to be able to do it, and partly because actually it solved additional problems, not just the programming problem. Because I've always had a soft spot for things like robots, whether it's robot arms or whether it's things that scurry around. When I first got a computer, when I was a teenager, I remember thinking, actually, if other than inside the TV, there was nothing in the world that it was doing, you know, all it was doing was changing the colors on the TV. There was no sound actually on a lot of the games, or maybe it made a buzzy beep, came out of the speaker. And so I sort of thought, and the one thing that the Acorn Atom did, also the BBC Micro did, was the cassette motor. That was the only thing that was sort of somehow was in the world.
Yeah.
And when it clicked, it made a noise from the computer. Mm. We thought, oh, I did that. You know, and it's bizarre. It's that feeling. So a robot is another step beyond that.
Yeah. I can remember writing programs just to make the spool reel go round on the data cassettes. I did that. That's about as far as I got. Future-wise, what's in the next year for Raspberry Pi? Where are you heading now?
Hopefully, at the end of this calendar year, we're looking at an educational release, which would be cased. It would be similar technically, but with software which we'd also provide for free to everyone who's already got the machine. And down the line, we've been talking to government. I know a lot of other people are very positive about rolling out Raspberry Pi into schools. It's already in a few after-school clubs. I'd like to see it in more and more of those. But ultimately, at some point, I'd like to see it given to every kid in the country. That's still the ambition. Whether the Raspberry Pi Foundation could afford to do that, I think that's unlikely, but might be possible with time. But I think I'm feeling a lot happier now that we've actually started the ball rolling. The fact that we've got a few competitors, I see as a good thing, because it means we've changed the way people are thinking. People are realizing, actually, there is interest here, there is money here. And where things before, which I think are great, things like Arduino, things like Microsoft Gadgeteer, they're very, very techie oriented, and they need a PC to drive them. One of the things I'd like to see, for example, is those devices hosted off Raspberry Pi. Yeah. So that you can, the whole path to making things is a very cheap path. There are also people that I didn't mention in the talk that are making components for robots, which are great. All of those things, I think, are feeling a lot more positive now and very, very excited about where it goes. And to an extent, the people who are involved with it are also a big part of where it goes. People have created all sorts of amazing things they didn't quite expect. You know, that one of the things that I showed on the talk was an excellent group who've got a, I'm trying to remember what it's called, Android thing which puts the Android picture up on your TV.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So you've got an Android smartphone.
Yes.
And, you've got your Raspberry Pi plugged into your TV, and you've got a Wi-Fi card attached to the Raspberry Pi, and so your smartphone sends the image, and so you can play games.
Sort of like an Apple TV. Amazing.
Yeah.
And great fun.
For less money, and like hacked by a bunch of people rather than a massive corporation.
And it's the hackery that really appeals to me. I mean, not in terms of any of the legality side of it, but it's great fun understanding how a device works. You know, where with a device like Raspberry Pi, where at its heart we've said, no, you can mess with this. You probably won't break it. And even if you do, there is an upper limit to the cost. Is very attractive. And the other thing that hasn't really happened and is just starting to happen is charities. Places like Africa, the reason we put on the RCA jack, which is the little analog TV adapter, I think we'll see, because it produces a picture, not as high resolution, it's downscaled, but it produces a picture on an analog television. So those people who've got them in their lofts, not working anymore, or a lot of Africa, mostly it's analog televisions they have. So one of the things that charities said is they have lots of access to it. They have power, they have analog TVs. It's just laptops don't last very long out there. They either get broken, or it bouncing around in the back of a Land Rover is not very good for them.
But with a Raspberry Pi, it's...
Yeah, you put it in your top pocket. And actually, it is quite tough. And I think with a case on it, it would be a lot tougher. You can drop it.
Yeah.
You can drop it on concrete from a height. And please, no, don't. But I'm pretty sure it would survive.
And talking about the case, something really fascinating that came up in your talk was that you were talking about the Scout Group and how they've they created... one of the things they were doing was obviously creating a controller for robots, and it had a brainwave device you could put on to control the robot via your Pi. But also, one of those people at the Scout Group, didn't they? They designed a case for it with Lego, didn't they?
Yes, and it's available as a kit. One of their number, called Biz, made a kit, but you can buy it as a kit from Lego. Isn't that great?
So you can make your own. You can make your own case out of Lego for your your Raspberry Pi computer, and it's great because it's got all the it's got space for all the inputs,
right.
And also the LED lights up the Lego as well, doesn't it?
That is the genius bit. The way it glows red is lovely.
Yeah. David Braben, thanks very much for your time.
You're very welcome. Nice talking to you. Thank you.
That's gaming legend David Braben speaking with Keith Stewart at last month's Develop Conference. That's it for Tech Weekly this week. Many thanks to our special guests, including Lily Cole, Jonathan Luff, Emma Mulqueenie, Keith Stewart, and David Braben. That's it from me, Alex Kratosky, and Tech Weekly producer Jason Phipps. See you next week.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.